right. Thanks a lot for, you know, the invitation, for having me here, and, you know, opportunity to talk. So I'll discuss some of our like high resolution modeling stuff. I will try to do basically two things. Try to be a little bit like informative, like try to explain what is like out there, where the a little bit of like the nice stuff, the state of the art is, and also discuss some of the challenges at the same time. So I'm gonna kind of like mix the two a little bit, which means sometimes I might not be so structured, but if you have any questions or something is not clear, just let me know and we'll figure it out. First, I would like to thank Daniel Chang, Joao de Hera, and Maria Shinida, who are essentially my co-authors in all of this. I worked with Daniel and Joao when I was at JPL, and Maria is one of my students now. And I would like to thank the people who gave us big computers to do some of the nice simulations. Okay, if you want some of the papers, just let me know. Okay, so we'll discuss...
a beautiful simulation.
Is it a simulation?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll discuss the atmospheric boundary layer mostly today. And this is an image of an atmospheric boundary layer. So as you can see, the white stuff are clouds. These are shallow cumulus forming over the ocean. And this is one of the deeper boundary layers. The cloud depth and the boundary layer depth is about 3 kilometers here. And these guys are deep enough so that they can precipitate a little bit. And there's interesting dynamics that happen because of precipitation. As rain falls below cloud base, it evaporates, it cools the surrounding air, and you get these areas here and here that are void of cloud, because you get this, the meteorologists call these cold pools. There's areas where the atmosphere is colder than the surrounding. And some of the clouds are big enough and they have a little bit of like anvils at the top. So everything here looks very nice and realistic. And now the question is this an instrument or a simulation? And this is actually a simulation. This is one of our runs. So the length scale here is about 20 kilometers. And this is what I want to discuss today, that there is a little bit of like, we're in this nice position to be able to have like very nice and realistic simulations. So this is, we have the computing power, we have the methods, and a little bit of like the knowledge of the physics so that we can deal with this stuff. Another thing I want to mention to our friends that they study the ocean is that in the atmosphere there are multiple phases. Like here it's a little bit nice because it's just vapor and liquid, and there's also rain, but you can get also like the solid phase, and this is okay because we're just dealing with boundary layers today, so we're not going to discuss any of the solid phase, but the solid phase is like really nasty.
So when people do these kind of visualizations, is that actually like the radiative forcing?
Yeah.
That it's coming out, so that's really what the model is.
Okay,
or
yeah, thank you.
Is this a visualization which has more?
No, this is
on top of it?
No, this is not a, so this is the result of a radiative transfer calculation. So I gave the LES data to Anthony Davis at JPL, and he has a Monte Carlo radiative transfer code. So he ran the radiative transfer, and this is exactly what he got. We didn't do like Photoshop or whatever, like this is just...
Yeah.
I mean, if you can get close enough, there's some like bad pixels and like junk from the model, but I mean, this is, it's not a visualization, it's actually, he wanted to simulate what an instrument would see. And this is how this picture came about. Okay, so this is a little bit of like the context that we're kind of like operating in. So this is the entire planetary circulation, all the atmosphere, thank you. Okay. A lot of the nice problems are, you know, climate or weather. They deal with like the entire atmosphere, but we'll just stay within like the fluid dynamics today. If you look at the fluid dynamics and the length scales that are created and the turbulence, it can go from about 10,000 kilometers to 1 millimeter in scale. And the difficulty here of the problem is that this range of scales, like the largest, the smallest, is 10 to the 8. And when you look at the current computational power, you can do ratios of this stuff, which is, say, this is the domain of the simulation, and this is the grid spacing. You can do 10 to the 4, maybe 10 to the 5 if you push it a little bit, but 10 to the 8 is no way. Okay, so a way to deal with this is that you break the problem into different models, different methodologies. So you have a GCM, you go from the whole atmosphere down to maybe a few kilometers. And then there's all this stuff that have to be parameterized. But you can fill this gap a little bit with LES. But LES also leaves a few stuff that are unresolved. And then you can do a DNS, where you start from the smaller scale and you go up as your computer allows. The promise of things like the LES is that when you're cutting off here and you're just leaving this amount of things that are unresolved, you're cutting away a lot of the complicated structure of the flow that is here. So if you're just left with this structure, then things would be a little bit easier. And this is sort of like the promise of the LES. So what so we kind of follow this, this kind of like a Russian doll approach. We do DNS, we do LES, and then we work on single column models for climate and weather. But today I'm just going to discuss about DNS and LES. So first, I will kind of like show you how this thing works. So I'm going to show you a series of DNS, direct numerical simulations, and then we'll go to the LES, okay? Okay, so this is a DNS, and the DNS is always very fundamental. It's very theoretical. It has a little bit of like no resemblance with, you know, weather or climate problems. So what we're dealing here, we're dealing with a flow that is sheared. The turbulence is caused by shear. And then there is a little bit of stratification in these cases. So this is the case where the stratification is very, very weak. Okay, so this is, am I doing okay here? Or? Okay, this is the one I wanted to show. Okay, so this is the case that stratification is very, very weak. Our parameter is this buoyancy Reynolds number. I think oceanographers use a little bit of different words for this stuff. Taylor Reynolds is 350. We actually have higher resolution simulations than this one, but it's a little bit tough to create movies from those. So what the colors here, what you see is fluctuations of buoyancy. So there is, in all of these simulations, there is a linear background stratification. And what you're seeing here is just fluctuations on top of this linear background.
Is this a convective simulation?
No, this is just a homogeneous shear simulation. And these runs are stationary. So we choose the shear so that exactly balances the total dissipation. So these runs are stationary, so there's an exact balance of kinetic energy in all of this.
Buoyancy is just a passive tracer.
So in this case, yes, buoyancy is just a passive tracer.
And the field you're plotting is buoyancy?
Yes. Okay, so this is, that's why.
There's a surface flux buoyancy source?
No, there's no surface here. This is triply periodic. This is it's a homogeneous flow, and we have a background buoyancy gradient, and everything is driven by shear. So this is the case where the stuff are a little bit more stratified now, so we increase the stratification. So what you see is two effects. First, the structures, they are not filling the entire height, and they're kind of like contained within this length scale. And I don't know if you noticed, but the shear is a little bit higher in this case. So that it, and then we go to the more stratified case, and now the structures are a little bit more confined in the vertical. The shear is a little bit more. You need to push it a little bit further, right? Buoyancy Reynolds number here is about 100. And I'll just wait for this. So you can see that stuff are not so much mixing here. They're kind of like sliding on top of each other. So if you push this a little bit further, now buoyancy levels is 10, you get into this state where you get this intermediate laminar turbulent layers. In this case, when we did the movie, the turbulent stuff were just here and it was just one layer, but sometimes you can get multiple layers in a simulation and these things tend to move around.
This is a single slice.
Yeah, this is a single slice through the 3D box. Okay, so this is everything now. So this is the 3D box. So this is X and this is the vertical. Obviously, buoyancy acceleration points downwards. So this is the XZ plane and this is the side view of the simulation. This is the YZ, okay? So this is sort of like the parameter space we covered, and here are some of like our favorite parameters. This is the gradient Richardson, flux Richardson, buoyancy Reynolds. You can define this L star, which is like a Reynolds number. It's a Reynolds number based on the L is the Obukhov length. This is the momentum flux, and this is the viscosity of the fluid. Because we're interested in gases here, we set essentially the Prandtl number to be 0.7. Okay, so any questions so far? Again, all of these are statistically stationary. You can run this for a long time.
What do you do at the top and bottom?
Also, the boxes are triply periodic, so they are periodic all around.
So you can do that with stratification?
Yep.
The mean stratification is
the
not periodic.
The mean is not periodic, but we're solving for the fluctuations, which are periodic.
Okay.
Well, it's actually shear periodic. So what happens is that the grid is kind of like doing this as the simulation goes by, and then we have to kind of like get the grid back in the vertical and things like that. But this is a little bit of a detail. Okay, so first and foremost, we have to make sure that we're doing everything okay. What this compares is the spectrum of the turbulent fluctuations for the slimwise and the vertical velocity. So this is the slimwise, this is the vertical. The red stuff here, these are the spectra that are measured in a wind tunnel. This is from Warhoff's group. They were nice enough to send us their raw data so that we can make the plot. So this is Taylor Reynolds of 450 and grid turbulence. So this is So the black is the simulation, red is the experiment. This is the signal-to-noise flow here. Simulation doesn't have these things with instruments and signal-to-noise, so you can go a little bit down in scales. The wind tunnel, though, is a little bit long, so they can get this part of the low wave number. But as you can see, the agreement cannot be better. And we checked a lot of other things, and everything was fine compared to experiments. Unfortunately, for slurrified flows, there's not a lot of well-controlled experiments, and we'll come back to this a little bit later, that they can be very helpful in comparing with the simulations and the models. Okay, so...
Is your simulation pseudo-spectral?
Yeah, this is a spectral code. Doing the simulation and writing the code and the validation and everything. So this is sort of like it's a lot of work. It's a lot of time on the computer, but this is a little bit of like the easy part of the job. So the difficult part is understanding what is going on and trying to extract some usefulness from all of this. So this is a little bit of like the useful part now. So this is a flow that is, it doesn't exist in reality. So it's an infinite flow, essentially, with shear. So it's like homogeneous isotropic turbulence. This stuff don't exist. So a lot of the people, they run these things so that they can study the small-scale turbulence. But we wanted to do a little bit more. So we wanted to use the entire turbulence in the box. So this is how this is the unslurrified case. And what you see is because of the the domain is periodic, so it cannot sustain a length scale that is bigger than this wavelength. So what you can do is that this is the shear that essentially is imposed. This is the turbulent flux that comes from the simulation, and this is the domain height. So you can recognize that this is a parameter for all of these runs. So what you can do is that you can take the shear, you can take the turbulent flux, this is a constant, it's like the von Karman constant, and you can extract this length scale called Z here. So this is like when you are in the surface layer and you have this characteristic length, that is the height from the surface. So this is equivalent to this situation. And this is going to be a little bit confusing in my slides because I'm going to use Z, but Z here is not the vertical coordinate. It's a length scale. So this, and we're doing this on purpose. We're confusing people on purpose because we want to kind of like feed into the surface layer or the Molyneux book of similarity theory. So you take the neutral case, you extract this length scale called Z, and then if you have the length scale, you can grind up a lot of the other things. And this assumption holds for infinite Reynolds number, and you can check by forming this essentially this Reynolds number here. And for our runs, it's about 500-700, and we will accept that 700 is a number that is very close to infinity. Okay, so after you get the length scale, you can use the dissipation. This epsilon is the TKA dissipation. This chi is the buoyancy dissipation, and these are the stars are the momentum fluxes as usual. This is the momentum flux, the U star, and this B star is the buoyancy flux in the vertical. Okay, so you can define these two
dissipations. Why do you not measure in your Z naught or Z star relative to the
Kolmogorov scale? Okay, because this is sort of like the large scale scaling of the stuff. We don't want to. You don't want to scale it with the small scales. You want to go because you are interested in the large scale.
You're comparing large to small anyway. You're doing it compared to U star Renu instead of the.
So you're saying that U star is a small scale?
No, it is.
But I'm saying that this is a large scale thing. Is this where we kind of disagree on this?
It's your talk.
Okay. I mean, we can talk about this a little bit later in detail. Okay, so after you do this, you can define this non-dimensional form of the spectra. You can get it for any variable. This is for the streamwise velocity, and this is for the buoyancy. And the spectra now look like this. So this is this line here. So these are multiplied by the wave number here. So minus 2/3, this black line, is the classical Kolmogorov scale. So the neutral one, this is the black, follows a little bit of the Kolmogorov scaling, and then the dissipation range takes on. But if you go to the stratified ones, and this is our stability parameter, this is this extracted length scale Z, and this L is the Abugov length. And as you go more stratified, this goes up. So you can see that these guys are peeling off from the Kolmogorov. So this is our DNS, and these are measurements in the surface layer, and this is a paper from 72. And you can see if you kind of like plot them at the same coordinates, they pretty much fall on top of each other. So this means that what we did works, and that all of this stuff here, what we did can scale the simulations. And this is a little bit like remarkable because this is turbulence in our box, and this is actually surface layer measurements. And so like I said before, so this scaling is a large scale scaling. So this is different than here. So this is a small scale scaling. So this is everything here is scaled with a Kolmogorov scale. So the tails actually aligned. They're aligned here. But okay, I'm going the other way. This is a scaling with the large scale. So the tails are misaligned. Okay, so this.
Not very much.
They're not very much, but.
It's still essentially a similar scale.
Okay, there's a, you know, there's a connection between the two, so they cannot be too far off from each other. Okay, so this is the streamwise velocity. So this is buoyancy, and this is our DNS. This is surface layer. So they pretty much agree, and then you can start asking a lot of other interesting questions. What is the scaling of the energy peaks? So you can scale them with the RMS and the dissipations. So if you plot them with this normalized by these scales, they kind of like a little bit line up. And these are the numbers, point this and this are the numbers that Kaimal and others found very long ago. Okay. So coming back to our methodology. So we did the DNS. We kind of have a way of explaining the DNS. We have a way of kind of like explaining how turbulence behaves. So now what we're going to do, we're going to use whatever knowledge we got from this part, the DNS, and we're going to try to build a model for the LES. And so we need a little bit of a framework to begin with. So we're going to use this this fancy LES model. It's called the stretch vortex LES model. It originally comes from Landgren and Dale Poulin and a lot of other people who worked on this. This is a model that assumes, as always, as usual for the LES models, homogeneity and stationarity of the subgrid scale model, but it's fully anisotropic, so it doesn't assume isotropy. So what we're going to do, we're going to take the standard model for the neutral flow, and we're going to aim to capture two effects, the decrease of TKE as stratification increases, and the increase of anisotropy. Okay, so this is how the standard model works for the neutral flow, and when I say SGS model in the LES world, it means that we have to figure out this guy, the tau ij. So this is the tensor of stresses that goes into the momentum, and every one of the scalars has this vector, the sigma I. So this is the SGS scalar flux. So these are the two guys that we have to figure out. And I would like to point out the difference here between LES and weather or climate modeling. A lot of the stuff we're going to do are very mathematical, and they kind of like have a strong connection with the physics. When you go into the weather and climate, people are kind of like going away from this mathematical formulation, and they're kind of like coming up with their own ideas about how the flow works. But here we'll kind of try to stay faithful to the physics. So the way the model works is that if this is a grid cell in the simulation, it assumes that in each of the grid cells there is this vortex that is wrapping the fluid and the scalars and mixing them. So this is a result from essentially theory. If you have this vortex, you can show that the stresses are density times the kinetic energy and this tensor. So this EI is essentially the components of the vector that points along the direction of the vortex. So in the simulation, we dynamically aligned these guys at every time step, at every grid cell, with the largest extensional eigenvector of the rate of slain. So every time you find the rate of slain, you take its eigenvalues, eigenvectors, you find the largest, and you align this guy, and you find this vector. Okay. So the TKE is just the integral of the spectrum, of the 3D spectrum, from the cutoff scale, essentially from the grid space, grid length up to infinity. And then you can form the subgrid scalar flux. So this is the resolve scale gradient of the scalar. We're going to use theta for our buoyancy here. This delta is the grid spacing. This is the kinetic energy. And there is also like this guy. So this guy is a tensor. So this is not the usual eddy viscosity, Smoot-Bodensky kind of stuff. So the scalar flux here is not aligned with the dissolved gradient because it's not multiplied by a scalar. It's multiplied by this guy, which is a tensor. So we have to make some choices now. So the choices are, what is the spectrum of the SGS turbulence? And we are going to assume that every one of these vortices is a Lundgren stretched spiral vortex with this type of spectrum. This is nice because it has k to the minus 5 thirds one, Kolmogorov prefactor dissipation, and then these are stuff that essentially take care of the dissipation range. This is the strain. This sets the shape, but not the actual value of the curve. So you need to know this thing that comes in the front. Essentially, this is the Kolmogorov prefactor and dissipation. So we're going to use a second order structure function called F2 to estimate these two things. So this is something that is typical in these kind of closures. Basically, what you're assuming is that at the grid scale and just below, there is a self-similarity of motions. So you can use the structure function at the grid scale to estimate the spectrum just below. Okay, well.
So that's a structure range just with like nearest neighbors or something like that. So it's quick to calculate.
Yeah, it's kind of quick. And you can have a choice between a spherical or a circular and things like that.
This is a rather different SGS model than I'm familiar with in LAS. Recognize its roots in Lundgren.
Right.
Trying to make the theory of turbulence often. What sort of literature is there comparing this sort of SGS with alternatives?
I have several papers that I can share, and I have some results. Okay. So the next three or four slides are a little bit like mathematical, but I will just gonna go quickly and you know, just kind of
You're not supposed to apologize for mathematics.
Yeah, I'm not in this building I'm not supposed to do this, but I found that the people in geophysics, sometimes when I talk to them, they are very scared of mathematics and they tend to run away. So
here you only have to apologize that you're not doing it on the board and that you're using.
Yeah, exactly. You only gave me 1 hour.
That's the mathematics. That's the mathematics. Where's the proof? Is it there?
Yeah. Okay. So the.
Never avoid this.
Okay. So these are not like. This is. Okay, I should apologize to the mathematicians now because this is this is not like serious mathematics. It's just grinding most of the times, but you have to grind a lot and you have to be careful with some things. So what we're going to do, we're going to for the stratified system, we're going to find two correction functions. This FK that corrects the TK, this K is for the neutral, and we're going to find this F of delta that corrects the length scale. So this delta is the grid spacing, so and this k is the TK, and we're going to find the new TK and length scale for S. S is our stratified flows, okay? So this is a typical thing with all SGS models. We are assuming stationality and homogeneity, and I've only seen a couple of complaints about the stationality argument of this, and they are not coming from the geophysical world, so I don't expect anyone to complain here about this. So this is the so this is a TK equation in each of the grid cells, essentially. Buoyancy flux, dissipation, kinetic energy production because of shear, like we had before in our DNS. We're going to go in this one. We are going to plug the relations for our SGS model from the previous slide. And now here, if you kind of like repackage everything, so we're going to define our like a vortex gradient Richardson number with this buoyancy frequency and this shear, and then we're going to say that this guy is our shear. So these guys that they have like this V subscript are not the real Lichardson numbers or the buoyancy frequency of the flow. These are kind of like made up Lichardson numbers and buoyancy frequencies of our SGS flow. Okay, don't, there's a difference between the two. So here we have three unknowns. We have one equation, three unknowns, kinetic energy, dissipation, and the length scale. Okay, so three unknowns, one equation. We have to try to get rid of some of the stuff. The first and easy to do is the dissipation. So we're going to use the usual assumption originally from Taylor, that dissipation scales like a length scale, velocity scale to the third, and length scale at the bottom. And we have this this factor inside here. So this is essentially our TKE here. So we're going to find the factor here, this constant, by matching to the neutral stratification. So if you do this, you can find, so everything here is known. You can find K. Now we're going to start defining stuff so that we're kind of like making our model relations similar to what we found from the DNS and the Molyneux-Obukhov theory. So we're going to define this Molyneux-Obukhov length, again, not the real Obukhov length of the flow, with the SGS kinetic energy, the SGS buoyancy flux here. So we're going to define the Obukhov length. So we have now a relation between length scales and TKE. The TKE is here, and you have length scales. So this delta is the grid spacing. This is the new characteristic length scale for the stratified system, and this is our defined Obukhov length. So the easy thing to do first is to go for unstable stratification. So if the stratification is unstable, it means that delta S is at least as large as delta, because the stratification doesn't have this confinement effect now. So this is the easy part. You can get rid of one of the length scales. There is no correction for the length scale. There's only correction for the TKE. And then you can find that the new TKE for the stratified system is the old one times this guy. And this is our stability parameter. Now, this is like this is grid spacing over our...
Is that a positive number?
No, this is negative now.
And is there a danger of singularity?
So because of some of numerical bad stuff that can happen in the simulation, you can get really high numbers of this, because this would go a little bit singular. So we have in the LAN, we have a sort of like a cutoff for this, so that things could not go wild and blow up, but we kind of have our version of like very high kinetic energy. Okay, now the difficult thing, the stable stratification. So now we have to have an assumption, because we have two unknowns, one equation. So we have to find one more equation. So we're going to use this parameterization, this mixture of length scales. So this is our stratified length scale. This is the grid spacing. And this is our Obukhov, model Obukhov scale. And we're going to blend this with this constant alpha. And this is something that people tend to do often in these parameterizations. I think the earliest I've seen this is from Brost and Wingard, 78. And after that, people have started using it a lot. So the difficulty here is finding this constant alpha. So you can show after a little bit of grinding and not very serious math that alpha should scale like this quantity in the limit of infinite Richardson number. So you can have this and flux Richardson from our DNS. So this asymptotes at about 5. So we choose alpha to be 5 based on the guide of the DNS. We checked for other numbers like 2, 10, 20 in the LES, and it made essentially no difference in the simulation. So we're very happy that this doesn't affect the results. And in the next slide, I will show you what this alpha does. So after you have this alpha, you can have a correction for the TKE. And so this now we need this Z, our stability parameter. And you can write this Z, zeta, as a function of our defined Richardson number. And so the Richardson number is related to the grid scale stuff. So this is the grid scale buoyancy gradient, right? So this is the these are the stuff you know from the simulation, the gradient of the velocity and things like that. Okay, so at every grid cell, you go do all of this, you find the Richardson, you find Zeta, and then you do the collection. The nice thing about this is that this Richardson number depends now on these vectors of the vortex. So this is a way of taking care of the anisotropy of the flow in the when you collect. Okay, so if the vortex is like this, it's in the vertical, and wants to kind of like spin things in the horizontal, no matter how high the Richardson number of the flow, the model says there is no stability collection, because you're not trying to overturn anything. If the vortex is kind of like this, and it wants to overturn stuff, the stability collection is maximum, no matter whether you're near a critical Richardson number or not in the actual flow. Okay, so this is the model is fully anisotropic, and there is you can show from the relationships between this stability parameter zeta and the vortex Richardson that there is actually kind of like a critical Richardson that you will reach. So this is neutral, is zero is here, so these guys are negative, these are positive. So the model will actually shut down and give you zero SGS fluxes when it thinks that the Richardson number is very high. And as you can see, there is no parameters here, there is nothing to tune. So this kind of like either works or not. Everything is everything is dynamic. You compute everything at the grid spacing at every time step. Okay, so this is the end of the tough.
One point of comparison, which I think was before you came, Rogachevsky and so Zinkevich were here, they essentially have a theory of high Richardson number turbulence. It's built out of the same sort of local energy balance ingredients that you're building. I wonder what they would say if they were in the audience right now.
Okay.
Have you made a point of comparing this formulation to theirs?
No. Okay, that's something that we need to, I guess, take a look at. Okay, so
theirs is, I think, inevitably simpler because they don't keep track of the vorticity orientation the way that you
How are you keeping track of E again, the vortex?
We're not keeping track of it. We are just, at every grid cell, we compute the rate of Slane tensor, and then we get its eigenvectors. And, I mean, this is the difficulty of computing essentially the eigenvectors of this tensor at every grid space, every grid cell, at every time step. Okay, so I have to point out that I started with the Langlands spectrum, but then I kind of messed up with all the math. So this is what happens with the Langlands spectrum if you put on top of this stability adjustment. So what happens is that it wants to shoot up from the k to the minus 5/3 when the flow is unstably stratified, but it wants to go down when the flow is stably stratified. And this is a little bit of, the second reason I'm showing this is that a lot of the people in the LES community, they will tell you something that is not completely, it's not true. They would say that at the grid scale, you need to have a k to the minus 5/3 spectrum, which means that you have to go very down in small scales. This originally started from like this Lilly 1968 paper, where it grinded up all the Smogolinsky mathematics, and he showed that in order to do the integral, you have to find a k to the minus 5/3 at the grid scale. But with this model, this is no longer the case. So your grid spacing can actually come very close to the Obugov or the Osmedov scale. Okay. So the k to the minus 5/3 is an SGS model dependent thing. It's not an LES thing, right? So LES is the methodology, and every LES has its own SGS model in each of the simulations, and all of these models they behave differently. Okay, so this is now we're going to see some actual LES results of how this works. So this is the DNS. Now these are actually higher Reynolds number than the ones I showed in the movies. So this is 2,000 by 1,000. So this is a DNS, and we call send the DNS to do the LES, 256.128. Neutral flow, a little bit stratified, more stratified, very stratified. So you can see the LES is adjusting to the situation, and you can see that the LES is kind of like predicting okay the vertical length scale here too. And I think this is the only LES model that can go into like this regime, where you can actually predict where the turbulence collapses and you get this these layers.
And that comes from the saturation, the high register numbers that you showed in the subgrid scheme before.
But other models like the Smogorinsky, they also have this saturation. So the model has to do the right thing of knowing in which regime you are. And typically, my experience with Smogorinsky times closures, Smogorinsky closures is that they tend to collapse the flow when you're kind of like here. They are too fast.
Related to that, a traditional difficulty with LES is turbulent transitions. They really are premised on fully developed turbulence.
Right.
You seem to have a turbulent transition in your lower right.
This model, for some reason, although it's built on, it doesn't have this transition mechanics inside it, it seems to do well with these regimes.
Have you tried the nighttime stable atmospheric boundary layer with this?
I will show some results of moderately stable ones, but we have some results that are very stable. The Richardson numbers are close to one, and the LES is doing okay. Like we get some okay scaling of, I'm not sure if it's like real turbulence, but whatever is is happening there. Okay, so we're going to do I'll show some of the results from the atmospheric boundary layer now with LES. So this is sort of like the easiest case. So this is just convection, hot surface, colder atmosphere, you get convection, you get these plumes, they hit some inversion at the top, you get a lot of steering, you get the mixed layer, and then inversion, stably stratified atmosphere at the top. So these are some of the things that we try. We run the LES at different grid resolutions, and we try to check that the results are independent of resolution. We have LES going from 10 meters to 80 meters, and this is the potential temperature profile, this is height, TKE, buoyancy flux. I am actually normalizing this with the inversion height here and with the momentum fluxes and heat fluxes here. The grid independence is true because this is the same for all of them. These dots here are measurements. And this is something I want to point out with this LES lens. When you take measurements in the atmosphere is not very steady usually. I mean, in the LES, you can say the geostrophic wind is like from the east, it's 5 meters per second, you can do the run for 48 hours, everything is so very well controlled, right? In the atmosphere, you cannot say the geo wind is this for so long and things like that. So the atmosphere is always a little bit messy. So the atmospheric measurements have always a little bit of scatter. And the scatter is more than what the LES usually gives for different parameters, right? So if you come to me and you say, I have awesome instrument XYZ, I got some measurements, I would like to give you some stuff to do validation of your LES, my question to you is not about the awesomeness of your XYZ instrument, it's about the control on your experiment, right? So this is a little bit of like the challenge now in taking measurements, because we have to know what are the controls on the measurements, and often people don't do this. They give you some profile of like fluxes or heat fluxes and things like that. They say validate. Okay.
So that's just the result TKE in the center.
No, this is the.
That also added in the subgrid.
Yeah, everything I show has the subgrid part added to it.
Okay, so that spread is real then. It's not just because the resolution is different.
No, this spread is the real prediction of the full TKE from the model.
My version of your remark is when someone comes and offers to validate, I tell them to go measure for 100 years.
Okay, so this is a little bit more difficult now. So this is a stable atmospheric boundary layer. This has actually a lot of rotation. This is at, based on some measurements that they were done at 53 north. It's the, essentially, the, for those who know, this is the first Gables case. So this is our results. going from 2 to 8 meters, the two velocity components and the potential temperature profile. This look very good. And if I can give you a little bit of flavor of what is out there, I picked a model from this paper, and I'm plotting their results here. So these guys go from 1 to 6 meters. We go from 2 to 8. Things are kind of okay, but the problem here is the height of the boundary layer, which is one of the most important quantities that varies a lot with resolution.
This is considered the bete noire of atmospheric boundary layer modeling. And the community has gotten together and made modeling and comparisons for a long time. The models don't agree, there's a lot of scatter. You're coming along and claiming robustness,
radiation
independence. So what are you, is it your subgrid scale scheme? What are you, you have a bigger computer? What are you doing that they're not?
It's the, so it's the SGS scheme, but also the numerical methods that we use. Some of the numerical methods we have are very high quality, they are fully conservative. We have no numerical dissipation in all of these schemes. So you have to have the combination of these two. And today I was not going to talk about numerical methods, just I was going to say this at the end of the talk. But we have papers that we have shown that you do the same LES, same SGS model, same sort of like nominal numerical method, you know, like you say central differences, and you change the order of accuracy from second to fourth, and the results change by a lot. So if you're trying to get some into some, so you can, I'm not saying that this is for every simulation, but there are regimes that if you're doing a difficult flow, and you're kind of like in a difficult regime, and you're not high fidelity in your modeling, you have to be careful, because in the end, everything, the mathematics are nice on the screen and everything, but in the end, we're just solving PDEs on the computer, so you have to make sure you're solving the PDE okay. So I come from a kind of like an engineering background, so when people are actually, when you submit your LES results, they're asking for grid convergence, but when I started doing these geophysical simulations, and I was telling to my friends that, oh, I try this at 3 resolutions, I get the same thing. They were like, "How is this possible? Like, how does this work? Like, you know, they thought I was maybe lying to them. They couldn't believe it. So the way this works is like this. So these are, let me go back because we kind of drifted. So I'm going to show you how the actual potential temperature field looks for 2 meters per second, 2 meters and 8 meters. So the way this works is that the LES is supposed to give you the statistics, right? So what you're after from the LES is the statistics. So this is the actual potential temperature in the LES. So this is when it's, the resolution is 8 meters, this one is 2. So if you increase the resolution, everything should stay the same with respect to the mean, for example, or the fluxes. So you can see like the yellow is where this yellow is here. But as you increase the resolution, what you are getting finer structures, as you can see from this guy compared to this guy. So this is kind of like switching your standard television to like an HD, like a 4K set. You're supposed to get the same programming, but the details are finer. So this is how the resolution independence.
So in the previous plot, your profiles had a vertical scale of order 10 meters in the detail.
Yeah.
Top of the boundary layer. If you have a delta X greater than 8, do things start to break down?
Yeah, they eventually,
of course.
After you have less than 10 points in the boundary layer, the boundary layer has scales that are smaller than your grid spacing, like this jet.
Referring more to the kinks in the second profile.
These ones, yeah. Exactly. So if you're not resolving the kinks, you cannot get the kinks. So this is it's a little bit of like a prerequisite for the resolution independence to happen. You have to resolve the dynamically important scales. So if you have, for example, clouds that are 100 meters wide, you cannot have a grid scale that is 100, right? You have to have a grid scale that is like 40 or something. Right? So you have to resolve first the flow, and then you have to get into the... But this is nice because if you have resolution independence with this, it affords you to go to coarser resolutions and still be a little bit accurate. So the name of the game here is how coarse can you be and be accurate, right? Because if you are coarse, then you can do more simulations, or you can run for longer. Like this is the point. Like the point is not to have like a big simulation, to do as little effort as possible with the maximum benefit.
And your grid, your spectral resolution is isotropic.
Yeah,
it's always isotropic.
It's always isotropic.
Okay, coming back to the last visualization picture. Isn't 1,000 meters horizontally awfully small compared to a vertical boundary layer of 200 meters? Do you have enough horizontal?
We checked. Now this depends a little bit on the statistic that you're after. We did a parametric study to check that this is okay, and we found that at least for the second order moments that we checked, it's okay. It depends on what you want sometimes. If you're interested in...
That's a narrow domain compared to, I think, more the common choices for people doing these kinds of problems.
I think this is actually bigger than the Intel comparison paper.
Paper?
The original paper, the Gables one paper. Okay, so the difficulty because of the problem with the observations and the measurements is to find ways of making sure that all of these things are doing okay. So we try to figure out ways of making sure that the results are okay. So this is these are different cases of stable boundary layers with different stratification, and they're kind of like encrypted in these funny numbers here. But this is local scaling, so this is height from the surface, this is the local Obukhov scale, and this is the Obukhov function. And if you plot the LES results that are these dots, they kind of collapse into these self-similar relationships. So this is sort of like an example of that we're doing okay. Okay, so now we're going to go into a little bit of like the two-phase flow. So now we have shallow cumulus. These are sort of like the trade wind popcorn clouds. So I'm doing the same thing here, changing resolution, potential temperature, height, total water, and this is the amount of liquid. So with this gray thing, gray envelope here, people did this modeling comparison in 2003, where a lot of the people, they give their model results to somebody, and then everybody plots them together. So there is a gray band, actually, on these ones. And this is what you see are the limitations of the model. So if you ask all of these LES models that they participated here, what is the profile of the temperature or the humidity, they will give you essentially the same result. But if you ask them what is the profile of the liquid in the cloud, they would have all of this variation between them. And the liquid is difficult because, as you can see here, this is 4, 10 to the minus 3, but the liquid is part of the total, and this is just 10, right? Yes?
But that's spread across models, and yours is spread across resolution.
Yes.
Minimal spread across resolution, which is impressive, but I mean, it's not comparing.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make this point that sometimes you can have a model that is not so good, but for some things it can do okay, and for some other things it cannot do okay. So the error spread is not uniform across variables, right? So bad model doesn't mean it gets everything bad. Okay, and I mean, of course, we are doing okay because we have different resolutions and we get the same amount of liquid. So now we're going to go a little bit further in physics. Now we're going to add precipitation on top of our cumulus. And I have this, so, go back. I think I'm over running the time allotted here, but I just have 3 slides. So this is how the simulation looks. This is how the LES looks. These are our precipitating shallow cumulus. So what we, the interesting thing here is the surface precipitation rate, because this is energy that is returned to the surface and doesn't stay in the atmosphere. And although the precipitation is not much, from the climate perspective, it matters because the area that this boundary layer covers in the ocean is very large. So even if it precipitates a little bit, the amount of energy in the bigger sense is a lot. So what we do here is that we start the simulation at zero. We run it for 24 hours. So this axis is time. And this axis is precipitation that reaches the surface. We convert to these energetic units because we're interested in energy balance. This is watts per meter squared, okay? So we did this in 2011. We're doing the same thing here, 20, 40, 80 meters resolution. And we're plotting the surface precipitation rate. And as you can see, there is no grid convergence. And this is logarithmic, right? So this is 10, this is 1, this is very little. So there is a lot of difference. So when you see this, the first thing you're thinking about is that, oh, you know, like the parameterization for the rain in the model is messed up, right? Because this is rain. However, there is this thing, because it's a linear problem, that the problem is not where you think it's coming from. So we try the same thing later. We change the Smogorinsky SGS in this guy. We did the same simulation. And we plugged in our new SGS, and the problem is fixed. So this is something sometimes called compensating errors in weather or climate models. If you try to fix this by changing the precipitation, you're making an error that compensates for the other error. So we have to be a little bit careful that sometimes you feel that the problem is in this quantity, but it's actually coming from the turbulence, because the turbulence is not creating the right clouds with the right depth, with the right thickness, so that they precipitate along. Okay, last thing I'm going to do is I'm going to discuss now stratocumulus. And what we're adding here is radiation. Okay, so we have some very nice, finely resolved simulations. We're running now at 5 kilometers in the horizontal, but some of them, they have grid spacing of just 1 meter. So this is totally 20 billion grid cells. So this is these are the largest LES ever performed.
I don't think I hear that. But
you know about somebody?
A little bigger than that. But okay. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay,
well,
you have to.
Within the same order of magnitude, though.
You have to show me, because I've said this many times, but this is the first time I'm challenged. Okay, so what happens here is that we're doing again this grid convergence thing. We're going from 20 meters to 1, essentially. Some of the stuff are okay. These now are measurements. When you go to the highest resolution, you get close to the vertical velocity variance measurements. But there is a lot of spread in the statistics. And this is decay. And this is liquid. So you can get from very much liquid to very little. So we thought, I mean, the model is good. There's something funny going on. So what we did another experiment in which we turned radiation off. So if you turn radiation off, everything is, the turbulent fluxes are nicely behaved. There is this problem still with the liquid. So what is going on here is that we are solving for the conserved variables. We're solving for the total water. And the liquid is just, so this is 9, and this is 0.24. So this is about 1,000 times less than this. So if you're making an error that is 1,000 times of this, which is not a big deal, you're getting the wrong amount of liquid. And then if you try to do radiation, because radiation depends exponentially on the amount of this guy, so the cloud at the top cools because it emits infrared radiation that depends exponentially on the liquid. So this is a very strong feedback. So you make an error that is 1,000th of this guy, you get big error in liquid, big error in radiation, big error in buoyancy. So these are a little bit of like the nasty stuff in these systems, that they have these feedbacks, they have this, they have non-linearities from radiation and precipitation that is of higher order than the, just the turbulence non-linearity. So things are, can go very wild, very fast. And with this, I will just stop here. I think I overran my time a little bit.
So this code is a real space grid code. It's not spectral.
Yeah, it's a finite differences.
And is the reason for that because you want to have conservative schemes, or because clouds have sharp boundaries, or some other reason?
I don't think there is. Well, one of the reasons is, like you said, we want to try different numerical schemes. When we do, for example, so for all of the conserved variables, we use these fully conservative schemes that they conserve kinetic energy and scalar variance. But when it comes to things like precipitation, for example, we use these monotone schemes. And I think this would be difficult if we had like a spectral code to do this. When we do rain advection, we have something special. So when you have finite differences, it's kind of like okay to kind of like get different finite difference schemes to kind of talk to each other to match the dispersion relationships. But if you have a spectral code, the dispersion relationship is exact, so it's a little difficult to manipulate some of these things.
Is JPL the main repository for this code?
No, I am the repository, so if you want the code, I can give you the code. It's not a big deal.
Can you go back to the forcing and strategy in the last case? Just the list of things.
This one?
Oh, wait, one more. Or,
this one?
This one, yeah.
Feels like a Quaker meeting.
Whenever you feel moved,
I have nothing to say.